There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Brighten up your home with help from Menards. Illuminate your home with LED light bulbs from Fight Electric. They provide light that lasts with a rated life of over 10,000 hours. Don't wait to finish your projects. Save big money on Fight Electric LED light bulbs now at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Hello and welcome to Contemplations. I am joined by Connor.
Hello there.
And I'm Josh. And today we're going to be debating about euthanasia. And this is, of course, going to be a civil debate. We're not going to be coming to violent blows or being rhetorical. I think we're going to actually have quite a constructive conversation. I'm glad to have you here because we have had back and forths before and they've always remained civil and productive. And I've always felt like even if we haven't come to a sort of reconcilable position, we've always gained something from the other's perspective. I would reference the one we did on abortion, for example, whereby we didn't necessarily agree, but through talking about each other's point, we got to a point whereby we respected the other's position and understood it better.
Yeah, well, we've strengthened our own positions by testing the metal against the other person's perspective. And judging by the comments on Contemplations as well, when we've done these sorts of discussions, the audience have found it very valuable to when we bring up pieces of information, arguments they haven't heard before when testing each other's perspective. So it's more for you guys' benefit, of course.
Yeah, and I think that actually when you have to apply your arguments to argumentation, it's kind of the best test of whether they hold up, isn't it? Mm. And quite often these sorts of conversations, even though they're going to be amicable, and ultimately we want to find the best thing for the world, and I don't think you have bad intentions, but these sorts of things are very, very helpful. And hopefully this helps you with food for thought. Obviously, you're probably going to have a position, you people at home, already, but maybe we'll come up with some things that you haven't thought of. So first and foremost, why are we choosing to cover this? And that is because it is in the UK Parliament, which Connor knows far more about than I do.
Yeah, so for the people who have obviously been following our coverage of Canada's MAID policy, the mass execution of Canadian citizens to save the government money on its state-funded healthcare policies, the UK, with the NHS on the brink of collapse because they won't stop mass migration, thought, well, that's a good idea to save us a few quid. So there is a sizable lobbying group that exists both inside and outside the House of Lords that have consistently pushed for assisted dying and euthanasia policies. And currently there is an assisting dying bill going through the Lords. It's just passed its second debate. I believe it still has to go through the committee stage, the report stage, a third reading, which means the debates between all of the Lords. And that's before it reaches the Commons, and then Commons keep redrafting it and then possibly pass it. It could still be blocked. But a lot of the time you see legislation like this, it's just a matter of time before it trickles through. Mm-hmm. So the actual legislation itself, we're going to link a lot of the things like the debates in the reading list at the bottom. There's some interesting back and forth over that. Some sophistry. One Lord tries to bring up a Christian argument for euthanasia, which says that, and I'm not BSing you here, that because Jesus on the cross had his side pierced by the spear of a Roman soldier, it's ethical to euthanize people who are dying. Now, people then brought up the fact of, well, he was already dead when his side was pierced. That was to check if he was dead. That's not really the case. The caliber of debate among our politicians is not excellent in the UK, but currently the bill reads that, subject to the consent of the High Court Family Division, pursuant to subsection 2, a person who is terminally ill may request and lawfully be provided with assistance to end his or her own life. This applies if the person has a voluntary, clear, settled, and informed wish to end his or her own life. that'll be a subject of contention, I'm sure, in this, has made a declaration to that effect in accordance with Section 3, and on the day of the declaration is made, is aged 18 or over, has capacity to make the decision to end his or her own life, vague, and has been ordinarily a resident in England and Wales for not less than 1 year, and also they must be terminally ill, so that is, they have been diagnosed by a registered medical practitioner as having a invariably progressive condition which cannot be reversed by treatment, and as a consequence of that terminal illness, is reasonably expected to die within 6 months. So there's a lot of presuppositions being packaged into the current bill, but not just procedural, like there's been lots of doctors that says we can't actually determine with a surefire accuracy the lifespan of a terminal illness. I know a man, for example, who had his cancer diagnosed and then within the space of being told he had a year to live was dead within about 3 weeks, specifically because they gave him morphine to deal with the pain that actually expedited his death. Yeah, it was tragic. And also, there's a lot of moral presuppositions packaged in here that haven't been fully teased out yet, I think.
But I think what we want to do here is talk more about the moral aspects of it rather than the practical legislation, although, of course, the morality ties into that because how it's going to be implemented is very important. The devil is in the details, after all. And I think what would be beneficial to talk about first is kind of the other side of the coin is our views on the death penalty, because, of course, this is, of course, the interface between the sanctity of human life and the role of the state. And I think we share a sort of similar reservation about the death penalty in that I think you certainly agree with it in principle, as do I. I think, you know, if someone is a serial killer, why should we keep them alive? I mean, there's no rehabilitating that person, is there? And if you're keeping them in prison on the state's behalf, well, you've got the taxpayers subsidising their imprisonment and ultimately their life. And I don't think that anyone should have to do that. I don't think you should, as a victim as well, have to pay for the incarceration of your perpetrator and pay for their food, their board, their upkeep, their guarding costs. It's absurd.
The example that, and I know Carl and Callum have also become fond of using this example, but that I've always used is the Lee Rigby killers. There is no doubt that the two men that killed military drummer Lee Rigby in broad daylight with many witnesses that stood around at the crime scene holding his severed limbs and head, the hands bloody, with the machete, shouting Allahu Akbar, which they also shouted in the docket when asked if they would defend themselves or not, were on camera, were voluntarily apprehended by the police. There is no doubt that these people butchered a man in front of people. And now what they've got is a free lifelong license to, unlike some of possibly Lee Rigby's colleagues, fellow servicemen who are sleeping on the streets as unemployed veterans, they are have their life paid for them. They have guaranteed TV access. They'll have food. They'll have meals, their bedding, and also they have the ability to go to mosque as many times a day as they'd like. So these Islamists are having their lifestyle, which is purely theological in foundation, subsidized by not just innocent people broadly, but also Lee Rigby's family are paying into the pot, which pays for their upkeep. So the penalty for not only regular people's innocence, but the loss of your loved one at the hands of callous murderers who can never be rehabilitated is to pay for them for a lifetime while your son is not around. There is no justice in that conception. Mm-hmm. So yeah, principally, absolutely agree. And I think for some cases, particularly like that, where there is absolutely no doubt, presently until deepfakes come along, of course, that can be applied. It's whether or not innocent people will be executed or it will be an arbitrary thing applied by a tyrannical government and the like.
Yeah. My problem with it is that I don't trust the government. I think plenty of people deserve to die. Criminals, that is.
Okay, Mr. Waternoose.
But it seems to me that there isn't enough of a disincentive for these sorts of violent crimes. And imagine the disincentive to Muslim terrorists if you gave them a burial where they believed that they wouldn't go to heaven.
Yeah.
Like you, I don't know, shoot them with a bullet soaked in pig fat or something, which is probably against the UN's human rights charter.
Oh, boo-hoo. There's the joke about bin Laden, that he was buried at sea so that he wouldn't ever face Mecca, but that does depend on the tide.
Oh dear. But yes, so I think we come at that from a similar position, don't we? In that, you know, we're concerned about the government because, of course, the way things are going at the minute with the government saying, oh, anyone to the right of Joseph Stalin is a far-right extremist and they're dangerous to our democracy. Well, we can see where this is going. We can see that people might become political prisoners, maybe branded terrorists or traitors. And
yeah, there's a very important point there, and that is that Carl's examination of the public support for the death penalty in his Sensible Centrist article relied on polling, and the polling was specifically for people who had been asked, do you support the death penalty for convicted terrorists? When they're thinking terrorists, they're thinking of the Lee Ruby killer or the London Bridge stabber or something like that. What they're not thinking about, because no reasonable person would, but people running Prevent, the supposed terrorist watch list, would, is that terrorism isn't Islamists blowing up pop concerts full of children in Manchester. It's Baz down the road saying, well, immigrants, they're expensive, don't like them. And so if the Overton window shifts to the point where you can imprison people for online hate speech, which is anything critical of the regime, and brand them with domestic terrorist charges, then the concern would be, would they be also susceptible to persecution up until the point of death? I hesitate to say that that is too extreme an example to get there, because it's highly possible that the people who pathologize our opinions as impediments to utopia wouldn't just kill us off. Like, that is not an unrealistic possibility.
Yeah, I think it's certainly possible. And I think that targeting, say, online podcasters would be something that they would do, particularly people of our stripe that are broadly anti the current thing. But at the same time, I don't want to over-egg it and say that I think that this is something that's coming or inevitable, because I don't necessarily think it's going to come to that, because that would be overplaying their hand if they start killing their opponents. That isn't wise from a political strategy point of view.
The current regime would not. If things continue down the road that they currently are, and some more dogmatic inheritance stepped into their shoes, then possibly. I absolutely wouldn't put it past them. Historical precedent says that. But let's put it this way. Does that fear prevent me from endorsing the death penalty in all cases in application? No, because again, I can come back to the Lee Rigby killer or Harold Shipman, who's prescient to this, for example. if you euthanize 100 people involuntarily and then steal their money from their will, then yeah, you don't deserve to hang yourself. You deserve to be hung in the public square with a placard around your neck saying what you did.
If you're not familiar with who he is, he's a very famous serial killer in Britain who was a doctor who basically administered a lethal dose of a drug, wrote down on their death certificate that it was various
pneumonia, old age and the like.
Things that wouldn't necessarily be questioned. And then mysteriously, they wrote wills giving all their money to him. So it was nakedly self-serving murder for monetary reasons. Which,
absolutely.
Yeah, someone like that, where it's entirely obvious that they're a malevolent, cannot be reformed person. Although I would be very hesitant to give the government power, they deserve it, don't they?
Yeah, there's no question about that. I use the reciprocal definition of rights, which is that I think all rights are predicated on innocence. So this is why you can be pro-death penalty and against abortion, because the baby has committed no crime. But if the rapist father, in the case of rape and incest, which is always used as the cudgel to say, well, this is the exception to abortion. Well, the baby committed no crime, but the father did. So therefore, kill the rapist, not the baby. I think that it's much like if you participate in the rules of a game, don't flip the board over if you want to keep being protected or playing the game. And it's not necessarily a form of societal self-defense, but there is some egregious wrong done to the social fabric if you allow a crime to go unpunished to a similar level of severity as the crime itself, because then innocent people as a constituency are at a moral deficit compared to the one criminal who can come in and destroy things. It's like how it takes 10 years to build something and 10 minutes to blow it up. You know, that's the same thing. So you need retribution in equal measure as a deterrent.
I mean, the libertarian in me feels very uncomfortable with the idea of the state wielding the power over life and death. And this is going to be a recurring theme throughout the whole thing. But I think in an ideal scenario, we would just have like the victim's family just carrying out justice, like mob justice.
There we go. Yeah, no, that's the thing. So I don't know, have you covered Hopper yet?
I know about his ideas somewhat.
Okay, yeah. So I'm about midway through Democracy, the God That Failed, and I've spoken about it with Harry before. particularly in our book club on Michael Knowles' Speechless, he came up. And his idea was, okay, if you have a self-governing moral community with a shared ethos and the willingness to protect it with armed defense, well, then you don't have anyone in that community which is actively seeking to subvert it or isn't contributing to its propagation, not just its economic propagation, but the repopulation. So you kick out the sexual perverts, you kick out the communists, you kick out the criminals. Okay, so if you are justified using force at that level, then does that scale up? That's the question. The issue that we come here is in procedure. How authentically representative is a government of the concerns of its constituents? At the moment, most definitely not. And that's where the misuse of the power comes in. Mm. But what level do we stop at in saying, okay, this is too large of a government and this goes beyond the community to where them killing a criminal is not justified? Because we can say, so Count Dankulis put up a couple of videos, for example, about the town that killed their bully. Right? Mm-hmm. And all the town look the other way. And to this day, they've kept a code of silence as to who shot him in broad daylight.
Or, I've seen that, yeah.
Yeah, the Gary Ridgway example. Not Gary Ridgway, what's his name? Gary Plouchet. Gary Ridgway's the Green River killer. Also someone deserves to die. Gary Plouchet, who found out that a karate instructor who he'd welcomed into his home when he was made homeless was molesting his sons. And so as they were transferring him to and from the airport, Gary Plouchet dresses up as a bystander, turns around and shoots him straight in the head and is charged, but not he doesn't go to prison, doesn't serve any time for any of it. And his wife, his ex-wife, says he never told her about it. And to this day, she said, if you would have told, he would have told you about it, would you have stopped? And she goes, no, I would have said you could at least let me drive you to the airport. That kind of thing where something is so...
She's a keeper.
Exactly. That's exactly what Dankula said, right? That kind of thing is so personal, so visceral, and it feels just intuitively. Like, eye for an eye isn't always wrong. What we're trying to negotiate here is to what point does that principle scale upwards and it bends too close to corruption for us to allow it?
I am also legally obligated to say that that is bad. But...
Are we?
I think so, yes.
Well, he got trialed for it and got let off.
Okay. All right then. Well, in which case...
Yeah.
It's good. That feels nice.
Yeah.
Thank goodness, not restrained by the law anymore.
There we go. Lovely. So, but anyway, the point being is, where does it come too close to not authentically representing the moral concerns of a community, which are so aggrieved that they are justified in killing, versus where do we fly too close to the sun in the misuse of power?
I think for there to be a crime, there has to be an individual or individuals who are the victim, right?
Yep.
And therefore, I think it should be the people related to them or the victims themselves should be involved in deciding what the crime is. Of course, you have the people in America who forgave them someone who murdered someone else and then they killed someone else.
Yes.
That's a really bad remembering of the actual case. But you know the one I'm referencing.
I know what you're talking about, yeah.
Yeah, they forgave someone for killing, I think it was their mother, and then they let him out and then he killed someone else. It's just like, you idiots.
Yeah. That is a particularly pathological version of Christian forgiveness, which neither I nor the Bible itself ascribes to. Anyone who's read Revelations knows that Jesus wasn't all too big on forgiving unrepentant sinners. He did say something about dying in eternal hellfire.
I think from my very limited understanding of Christian teachings, it's about wanting to change. You forgive people who've realized that they're wrong, that you're not doomed temporally.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it comes back to the principle of reciprocity. Okay, if you respect my rights, that's fine. The moment you infringe on them, then your rights are forfeit. If you are willing to make restitution, if you recognize your wrongdoing, then you're worthy of forgiveness. If you don't recognize the moral grievance you have committed, then you don't warrant my forgiveness, and you have condemned yourself to living in hell, either as a place mentally on earth or physically, metaphysically, whatever the hell happens after we die. I don't know,
but I think we've got a good foundation here to now go on to the actual topic at hand of euthanasia. And I think that my main argument, I'm just going to lead with the main one, and I'll see what you have to say about it, is that If people don't have the right to make the decisions about their own life or death, decisions about their own life ultimately, then what decisions do they have? I mean, it's the ultimate personal choice in my view, and that if someone is, say, suffering, they've got a terminal illness, they're in constant pain, there's no chance of it being cured. It's basically impossible. It's something that's right. like degenerative to the point whereby, you know, you're not going to be the same person in the end. And they say, before it gets worse, if I get to X point, I don't want to live anymore. It's worse than, you know, this is worse than death. And I think that there are many instances where human suffering is worse than death, and that death is a mercy. And I think that there's been this informal understanding for a very long time. When, for example, you in warfare, someone is they're very close to death and they're going to die anyway. The merciful thing is to put them out of their misery, isn't it?
Okay, there's a lot to unpack there.
Mm-hmm. It's all right.
No, it's fine. My quandary. So the I'm just trying to remember the start particularly. So my contest immediately. I'll go to the sort of acting in procedure, because that seems to be the easiest argument where we find common ground.
Right? Sure.
That is that if you create a legislative framework which allows for euthanasia, number one, neither of us want state-funded healthcare, but with the mm-hmm. present framework in the UK and Canada and the like, there is going to be cost-cutting calculations with death panels who think, okay, if this person is occupying a hospital bed for a certain amount of time, then we can, if not force them to take their own lives, but at least coerce and pressure them and make them feel like a burden on their
family.
That's
obviously horrifyingly dystopian, right? There shouldn't be... I'm going to add a caveat here. There shouldn't be any coercive force. The choice has to be authentically the individual's. It shouldn't even be up to close family members. Like, right. Because I know that one of the main reasons that people are interested in being euthanized in the first place is that they don't want to be a burden on their loved ones. Yep. But actually, I think that not that I'm, you know, making their decisions for them, but I think they might be... underemphasizing the importance of their own life on the people around them, and that perhaps they're being a bit too hasty. But if it's from a personal suffering point of view, if they're in constant pain, if you know, they say, you know, I get Alzheimer's to the point where I'm not even myself anymore. I'm not even a human being. Basically, I've regressed to the point of being. I've used the wrong word there. I didn't mean to say even a human being.
No, that's how people will conceive of themselves. So it's not wrong that you yeah, say that. But that is worth picking up on.
Mm-hmm. Not a functional human being would probably be the best way of putting it. But degenerate to the point whereby, you know, I'm completely incapable of functioning. And that's their choice. No one else has made it for them. Like, okay, I want to end my life on my own terms before that happens, or when I start to show signs of that, I don't want to live in that world. Because my grandparents had, I'm not going to use a sob story to try and convince you.
No, it's not.
But it's just relevant to contextualize the suffering.
Josh, you're a friend. I would never accuse you of being manipulative. So like, personal experience actually is relevant here. Come on.
One of my grandparents had dementia, and it was a really quite harrowing thing in that we had to put her in a home because she needed 24-hour care, because my grandfather was, you know, in his 90s. He can't look after someone full time. He needs to be looked after himself. And, you know, at the time I was young, I wasn't capable of doing so. My parents were working, and so we had to hire someone to look after them. And in the home, basically, she regressed to the point where she had no sense of self necessarily. She didn't really know where she was. She would constantly say, oh, I want to go home. I don't know where I am. Who are you? To the people looking after her. It's a really harrowing thing. And it got to so bad going down the line that she thought she was a child again. And when you talk to someone who you love, and it's almost like they've been possessed, there's something animating their body. You see the person that you recognize, but yet it's not that person anymore. it's really, really harrowing, because it's almost worse than them dying emotionally to the people around you, because not only are you seeing the person that you loved fade away, but you're also then seeing something reanimate their corpse and dance around to torment you, basically. Not to put it in really brutal terms.
But no, I agree. It happened with my aunt's mum, who was a real character and always used to ask me about the exercise book novels I wrote growing up and all my action figures and stuff. She got it and she forgot her husband. She would start screaming at her daughter, saying she didn't know who she was. And it was a prolonged grieving period where you're also, by the person that you're caring for, you're treated as an enemy, and they don't even know they're doing it. So you can't, there's also like a blame complex thing where you feel bad at the fact that you resent them for something they can't control, but you're also spending a lot of emotional capital taking care of someone, which is a good thing to do. And then you feel guilty about the fact that you're feeling sorry for yourself because it's beyond their control, but also you inevitably, of course, feel terrible if you're being berated by someone you love that doesn't even know who you are anymore. You know, it's...
Yeah, and it got even worse to the point whereby, because we lived in Plymouth, and that's obviously where I'm from, there's a naval dockyard that stores nuclear weapons, and they have a siren that they let off to test in case of, say, either nuclear attack or accidental nuclear detonation at the dockyard, because they have nuclear submarines, lots of stuff that I know about in Plymouth. I know lots of people that worked at the dockyard, so very familiar with that. But they would sound this siren off, and it was within earshot of this home where my nan was staying. She grew up in the war, and obviously when you hear a siren,
right, yeah,
it's associated with air raid, World War II. And so when the siren would go off, obviously...
She was routinely petrified.
Exactly. And if you knew that that was the fate that you had in the future, that sort of torment, not only of your own mind, but of all the people who love you, I can certainly understand why someone would want to end it before it gets to that point.
Yeah.
And I think it's that personal experience that makes me want to allow people to do this, because otherwise I would be very hesitant to have this sort of thing, because of course you might get a thing like in Canada whereby the state is coercing people. But I think that having a very strong line in the sand saying, okay, you have to have the individual consenting. You can't have someone else signing off. You can't have other people coercing them. It has to be their decision. And of course, there are problems there in that you could say have a tragic accident where someone's basically a vegetable, but then it's almost like the practice of writing a will. Imagine having some sort of practice of, okay, well, if I'm in this condition, I don't want to live like that. I know that there are many circumstances where I'd be like, yeah, I'd rather not live through that. Say I got hit in the head, there's nothing left of me, I was basically like childlike intelligence permanently. I'd be like, well, yeah, just unplug me, forget about it.
It's a very strong emotional case, and
yeah,
I
always dislike using emotional cases in political arguments, because it does have that character, and I know we've already addressed that, but
yeah,
I think it's important to humanize the individuals in question, because when you talk about it in the abstract, lots of different thoughts are salient than if you ground it in the reality of personal experience, because ultimately the moral element to my argument is that it affects all the people on the ground level. I don't want to be thinking about the government. It's more about ordinary people's daily lives and trying to make it them as healthy as possible, I suppose.
Right. Okay. So I don't disagree. I take umbrage with a few things in the framing there, and it's in the same way I am frustrated by the legislation they're pushing forth. And, okay, one of the things I take issue with is the idea of the possibility for informed consent, particularly when you are cognitively impaired, with the Alzheimer's example, also with the idea that you can ahead of time determine that you want to have your life support switched off if you are comatose, particularly because you can't guarantee that this person won't wake up in all scenarios. Yeah. And also, one of the things that rubbed me the wrong way instantly when you started characterizing your argument a few minutes ago was that you said that if you don't have control over your death, then what other fundamental rights do you have?
Obviously, no one chooses to die.
No.
But it's more that if you want to die and the state prevents you, I see that as a great affront on a person's dignity, really.
Okay, so couple of things disentangled there. We'll set the point about universalizing moral prescriptions aside for now, because that's another rabbit hole I want to go down. But the same cannot be applied to suicide. That's also the issue. So if the state, or let's say community-based mental health services, so we don't just talk about the state because we're both annoyed by the government. If they don't intercede when someone is not in their right mind, doesn't have a terminal illness, but does want to kill themselves, then are they inhibiting someone's maximum autonomy? Because they're making a quote-unquote voluntary informed choice, right? So what's the difference between there and being in physical pain versus emotional torment?
This is one of those areas that actually I wanted to kind of bounce off of you, because I'm not sure how I feel about it. Because one of the reasons that I was hesitant going into clinical psychology is that you're basically talking down to people from an elitist perspective, aren't you? Say someone actually had a legitimate reason to be depressed and miserable.
I think I've had some in my time, let's put it that way.
But say they were the only survivor in a car crash. This is hypothetical, of course. And all their family died. And, you know, they lost their job because they weren't able to cope with carrying on. You know, they just don't want to carry on with life anymore. And then you've got to say to that person, you know what? You're wrong, actually. You can be better than that. You can recover from this. And I think that my knee-jerk reaction is to say, well, who are you to say that they're wrong? Like, from what position do you know what it's like to be that person suffering through that? And I'm not sure how to articulate it, but I think that there are certainly cases where people are depressed because of, say, things that are irreversible. But I also think that there are cases where people have been through such horrific experiences in their life that there's no escaping the inevitable depression that will ensue. And I feel like there's almost a separation of the two there, whereby the people who are just, you know, sitting in their room, they're not really doing much with their lives, but there is potential for change there. I think people should do everything in their power to help them, put them on the right track, right? And but with the people who I think have given up on life, you see them on the street, don't you? You see people basically drinking themselves to death, taking drugs, basically not caring about their own well-being and just doing things to alleviate the pain and bring about an earlier end. Well, that's a bit more of a complicated situation, isn't it? Because I would be sympathetic to why they would want to end their life, even though it doesn't make me feel comfortable. And part of me feels like, am I doing what makes me feel better about myself by keeping them alive? But then I can say, well, I'm not having a hand or tacitly supporting them killing themselves. I mean, it's a very complicated question. And I don't really know how I feel about it, because I can see all sides of it, if you know what I mean.
Okay, so I'll tackle this from a quick comment from experience, and then I think this hits at a heart of a moral contention between you and I. From experience, I won't get into reasons why, but I feel like I was one of those people in my late teens, and if I heard all you just said, I wouldn't be here. So I feel like if you get trapped in that fatalistic mindset, and then the person that you're relying on to give you a lifeline is agreeing with the nihilism that you are lost in, that is going to lead to a lot of people with a lot of potential just cashing their check in too early.
I actually agree with you there, that you shouldn't give up on people. That's not what I'm saying. Or tell them that they're right necessarily. But I think there are certainly people who their suffering is so great that I don't think there is any recovery for that. And if it is their individual choice, although it makes me feel very uncomfortable, I don't really know how you can get around that.
Oh, okay, so this is something to parcel out, the difference between rights and abilities and responsibilities and moral obligations. And also something that you're... All the examples you've given so far are very imbued with a sort of subjectivist utilitarian calculus as the person weighing up their perception of suffering in the present, and so it makes the issue of self-destruction it's not that it's black and white, moral or immoral, it's just a choice based on circumstances.
Mm-hmm. But it has to be grounded in the subjective, because ultimately
this is where we're not going to agree.
The experiences are the central thing. The suffering is an experience, and therefore it's something that a person perceives. So the subjective has to be at least relevant.
Okay.
Otherwise.
So then you're positing a value hierarchy where suffering can trump the value of human life. So is the value of human life not innate?
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right.